Oh, dude, Jay, Weapon X is so good.
Ah, I know. There's that gorgeous Barry Windsor Smith art. Not to mention the foundation for decades of intricate recons.
Right? Truett freaking Hudson?
Wait, who?
The professor. You know, the bald guy who's kind of a jerk.
Miles, the bald professor who is a jerk is Charles Xavier. We've been over this like for 3 straight years. Are you okay? Do you need an adult?
No. It's the one from Weapon X. You know, Dr. Cornelius's boss.
Oh, okay, that professor. That makes slightly more sense, at least. You know, what ended up happening to that dude anyway?
Silver Fox killed him ages ago.
Wait, Silver Fox, Wolverine's ex?
Yeah.
Ooh, bummer.
What I keep wondering, though, is who the hell is he talking to in Weapon X? The program's directors, I assume.
Well, specifically, apparently, the person on the other end is Romulus.
Romulus, the wolf guy?
The wolf guy.
Why is Weapon X in touch with Romulus?
Dude, Romulus has been manipulating events for millennia to get Logan booted up. He's like, I don't know, if Mr. Sinister were super into claws and maybe way less glam.
Wait, I thought he was the first of a race of humans who had evolved from canines instead of primates. Wasn't that what he told Wolverine?
It was, but apparently it was complete bullshit, within the comic as well as to readers. He was just telling Logan to distract him.
Oh, well, that's a relief. So Logan was his big endgame.
Well, part of it anyway. I mean, Romulus did also raise Dokken.
Is that why Dokken has the adamantium-coated claws?
What? No, that's not adamantium. That's the Muramasa sword.
What?
I'm Jay Edidin.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we are here to explain the X-Men.
Because it's about time someone did.
Welcome to episode 162 of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, where we walk you through the ins, the outs, and the retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera.
And welcome to an episode that I am really excited about. We're doing a super fun story today.
But first, you know what else we are really, really excited about? Rose City Comic Con, which is coming up in less than a week as you listen to this episode. And we have some big plans this year. It's the first time we're going to be back in the same place since, I think, April. And we are celebrating, as we usually do, by throwing a party and listener meetup. It's at our usual venue, the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, on Friday, September 8th, from 7 to 10 p.m. There's no cover, and it is, as usual, all ages.
And on Saturday, we'll be doing our first of two panels. This will be the one that goes up as a live Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men episode. And if you want to be part of that episode, you totally can, with your butt in a seat in front of us.
You know, you can also stand in the room. They will be okay with that. We'll be okay with that. Or hop. I mean, if you're quiet about it. Or hover. You can hover quietly. The point is, you should come. It's going to be great. We are going to go in real deep on politics in ways that we almost never do on the podcast. And if you are into the mutant revolution, this one's for you. But that is not all we are doing at Rose City. We've also got a panel on Sunday. We're gonna record this one too. I don't know when or where it's gonna go up, but we are teaming up with the amazing, funny, brilliant Tighten Up the Defense, which I am so excited about this. I think this is the thing I'm most excited about at Rose City.
It's going to be pretty awesome. Having known Hub for a little while and having met Corey all of once, I'm excited to talk a comics minutiae with them.
Yeah, no, Corey is super elusive and mysterious. He's like whoever the professor's talking to in Weapon X, but I think he's way better than Romulus, I
I
hope.
mean, it's hard not to be better than Romulus. Stupid Romulus.
That is true. Literally everyone is better than Romulus. Maybe not the Strucker twins.
Oh, God, Fenris? Yeah, they're basically the worst.
Yeah, they suck.
But anyway, if you're at the show, we'll also be occasionally tabling with Ma'at Crook, so.
We're only going to be at the show on Saturday and Sunday. We are going to be setting up for the party and attending to other business on Friday, but we will be there all day Saturday and Sunday and on and off at Mott's table, and we'll have buttons and zines and some other smaller stuff, and obviously high fives in abundance.
All of that said, Jay, what are we talking about today?
Today we are talking about a story that first appeared in the anthology title Marvel Comics Presents. And Marvel Comics Presents was an anthology, and it was dominated overwhelmingly by Wolverine, as were many comics of the era. This is one of the best Wolverine stories to run in it, and I'm going to go ahead and say that this is one of the best Wolverine stories. This is a classic. It's been collected in a number of different shapes and forms. This is the original Barry Windsor Smith Weapon X.
Exactly. Now, Barry Windsor-Smith may be a familiar name to you as an X-fan or just a comics fan. He's largely known for doing a whole bunch of awesome Conan comics, and like, seriously, even if you don't think you would like Conan, his comics are still really worth checking out.
Yeah, he's just a phenomenal artist, and with this series, one of the things that I learned is he's also a really phenomenal writer. If you're interested in following along, this appeared over the course of, I believe, 13 different issues, starting with Marvel Comics Presents number 72.
And this isn't Barry Windsor-Smith's first exposure to the X-Men either, because he did a few of our favorite issues, namely Life Death 1 and 2, that's Uncanny X-Men 186 and 198.
He also drew Wounded Wolf, that was Uncanny X-Men number 205, and he's been particularly notable on the podcast as the guy who draws the best naked X-Men.
He really, really does. I mean, we had a scantily clad but non-sexualized except when she was supposed to be Storm in Life Death, and now we have Logan just wearing a whole lot of computer stuff and a whole lot of Logan fur.
Oh, he was hella naked in 205, too.
Oh, right, when he was fighting Lady Deathstrike and was all torn up in the snow and Katie Power was there getting traumatized.
Yeah, this, however, this is definitely, like, 80 straight pages of fully nude Logan.
It's just Wolverine Cox. Page left, page right, nothing but Wolverine Cox. There's not even any dialogue. It's just lovingly drawn.
That's... Miles is telling you lies. There are definitely no visible penises in this story.
Well, anyway...
Or any other pudenda, human or otherwise.
Well, what we do have is some of the best-defined Logan backstory. Now, if you've been an X-Men fan for very long, you know that, like, half of X-Men continuity is just ridiculous Wolverine nonsense.
I think it's hilarious that you describe this as best defined, because I think this is among the best Wolverine backstory because it remains so ambiguous. I have very strong feelings about this, actually. Can I talk a little bit about my feelings about Wolverine backstory and what you should and shouldn't show?
Let's absolutely do so.
So I feel roughly the same way about Wolverine that I do about the Joker. In terms of backstory, and in many other ways, I feel very differently about them. But I think both characters become exponentially less effective the more of their explicit origins are made canon. With Wolverine, I think he works best in the semi-abstract as a cipher with occasional hints, brief details, you know, having a, this is where Wolverine was during this period of history. This is what he did for a week in World War I. This is what he was off to for 2 days in the 70s and some murders. That's great. I am into that. That's fine. But this is where Logan comes from. This is where Wolverine comes from. This is the single canonical origin. No. For me, that breaks a lot of the appeal of the character. I mean, and one of the things that I love about this particular story is that Barry Windsor-Smith is such a profoundly unreliable narrator. There is actually no narrator in this story, which works even better. It plays with perception and it plays with narrative fealty in ways that I think are absolutely ideal for exploring Logan's past.
Well, and it's funny you should say that you feel that Logan's past should be not covered in too great of detail. Chris Claremont actually thought the same thing and said, "I decided that Wolverine's origin was a story that should never be told. I feel that the drive to explain every split second of every character's existence is absurd. Where's the mystery? Where's the fun if you nail it all down?"
I wholeheartedly agree with Claremont on that, and I think that's actually a sentiment that for me extends to other superheroes as well. The more you try to ground characters with superpowers in real-world science, the more glaring the gaps start to get. This is one of my main issues, for instance, with the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. Because they work so hard to make him realistic and possible in the real world, the places where he isn't just seem goofy as all hell. But if you take a looser approach, then there's a lot more that audiences, I think, are willing to take as read and a lot further that they're willing to suspend disbelief.
And so one of the things that I think works so well about Weapon X, about this story right here, is that while we are seeing a period of Logan's life in very great detail, it's a short period. It's basically the origin of his adamantium skeleton and claws.
Maybe. One of the things that I love most about this story is that it's never entirely clear just how much of it actually happens. We're going to get to more of that as we're discussing the story and its larger context, but for now, let's talk more about what's on the page. So this is long for a Marvel Comics Presents story. This is 12 8-page chapters and then a 13th that's 24 pages.
Yeah, normally Marvel Comics Presents stories are 8 8-page stories, so this is significantly bigger than that. But for a story like this, I honestly can't imagine cutting out any of it. It's just so tightly, deliberately told and paced.
And this is how you do a long story. That said, it's really hard to imagine reading this in serial. The disjointedness is so fundamental to the shape of it, but at the same time, The idea of trying to follow it from month to month is a little bit vertiginous.
Yeah, I mean, you do get your Marvel Comics Presents-style cliffhanger at the end of every chapter, but, like, it would be hard to remember all the details, and it would be hard to maintain that feel.
Well, it would be hard to remember the details you get. You don't get a lot of details, and again, we're going to get to that more as we're covering this. I want to step back a little bit, though, and talk more about continuity and origin stories, because I realized as I was talking about that's kind of an ironic stance to take on a podcast that's all about unpacking and untangling continuity. And I kind of want to address that, because for me, they're two sort of separate issues. So continuity is a mess, and it's a glorious mess. And it's a mess that largely came from decades of not having things like marvel.wikia.com or the internet in general, and what happens when a lot of people are telling stories and not tracking this stuff, and what happens when the main people tracking this stuff are fans, and what happens when those fans then become the creative forces behind the comics. And this podcast has never been an attempt to create a single coherent timeline. That's never been the way that we approach the material, and that's never really been our goal. We've been more interested in unpacking it and looking at how it connects and looking at the ways it could connect and has connected and looking at the ways that people retroactively connected it and the way the stories took shape. So, I mean, for me, those two interests are pretty fundamentally compatible. But yeah, this is a place where I think continuity should always take a backseat to resonance.
All of that said, do you want to dive into Weapon X?
Let's do it. Let's hook up some wires to an angry naked man.
For us, it was Wednesday.
But can he turn into a bear? That's the real question that we have come to ask of all new gentlemen in Marvel Comics.
Well, you know, just has to get the right leather and head to the right clubs. It'll be fine. And then Jay broke.
I feel like a good portion of our listenership just had to pause and, like, punch the air and clap.
Anyway, so the prologue of Weapon X has a really cool storytelling technique as it just cuts back and forth, sometimes multiple times on the same page, between what Logan's up to at this undefined, probably 1960s-ish period of his life, and what some entirely unrelated people are up to. We open with a bald man picking his glasses up off a folder named Experiment X, and one of the visuals I love here is that as the glasses come toward the viewer, you just see the words X-Men through the lenses. Nice, nice, Barry Windsor-Smith.
Ha, well played. This experiment has nothing to do with the X-Men, but nor does Logan at this point. He is running around Canada in a plaid flannel shirt, getting in bar fights.
Elsewhere, a bearded man is reading articles about himself, apparently a guy named Dr. Cornelius. He's a fugitive doctor accused of malpractice and of mercy killing, and he makes a phone call. Meanwhile, that bald man we mentioned a moment ago is interviewing a woman with short hair. It looks like, for a job, this is Carol Hines. And so Dr. Cornelius, the bald man, and Carol Hines, they're going to be the trio that's behind a lot of what's going on throughout this entire story.
As the bald man interviews Carol Hines for a new job, we find out why Logan was let go from his last one, something high up in government intelligence or the military. He was an alcoholic, he was unpredictable, and he was obsessed with mutants. He critically wounded a staff member and was promptly fired. In his current life, he's drinking, he's taking pills, and he is at firing ranges making bad, bad choices.
And we then cut to an image of an inverted monkey in red liquid, bubbles and tubes covering its face, metal protuberances sticking out of its limbs. And the glint of the bald man's glasses are in a panel overlapping all of this. And we have this great feeling of disorientation through all this. We have it cutting back and forth from Logan doing things, from these random scientists doing seemingly unrelated things, from experiments going on. And it's almost like the opening montage of a television show, like the opening credits. And it really draws you in. It manages to show you all these little bits of detail without showing you how they're connected. And so your brain just wants to jump on that shit.
And then the man with the reflective glasses recruits Logan to a shady government program. And Logan, despite being terrified, repeats to himself, "I mustn't run away. I mustn't run away."
James Howlett and Shinji Ikari. I can't think of any overlap whatsoever between the two of them.
No. The entire overlap is between the professor and Gendo Ikari. And the entire overlap between them is shady government programs and reflective square-shaped glasses.
But anyway,
Logan wakes up from nightmares, not of, you know, angels or any of that fun stuff, but of shadowed rooms and claws, sweating.
As Dr. Cornelius, the bald man, and Carol Hines set up a laboratory full of screens and tubes and panels, all silent. Everybody so far has been silent. We've seen narration captions, but no dialogue.
Logan watches an oncoming storm through the window of his wrecked hotel room.
Hell is coming.
Yeah, no, this is a really good opening montage. And the next thing that's going to happen is that these two storylines are going to converge. Logan walks out to his car, a Lotus 7, incidentally, because he has the same taste in cars as Number 6.
I still haven't seen The Prisoner. I know I need to.
I feel like I should just stop podcasting with you until you've seen The Prisoner. It's so important, and you would love it so much, and it's brilliant, and it's amazing, and I'm actually vaguely offended that you still haven't watched it.
Okay, I gotta get through Twin Peaks Season 3, which is some challenging fucking viewing, and then The Prisoner as soon as I can after that. Scout's honor.
I don't believe you.
Aww.
I'll believe it when it happens.
Entirely reasonable.
You've been saying you're gonna watch The Prisoner for like a decade now, buddy.
I suppose that's true.
And on his way to the car, which I realized I'm not certain is actually his, it's just the car he's walking towards, he is attacked by three men in suits. They've also got guns, and they manage to subdue him and start to load him into the car, into the Lotus 7, which is why I figure it's probably not his.
Maybe, yeah, but he, being Logan, wakes up and starts fighting. And the comic here alternates between scenes of Logan in this desperate fight against these secret agents or whatever the hell they are, and the lab being further set up. And once again, we have this back and forth. What was previously an intercutting, almost introductory montage now just shows the duality between the two scenes. We have lots of dialogue and yelling and very night blue dark colors during Logan's fight. And then in the lab, we have these bright, almost garish colors and no speech bubbles, but instead just color-coded caption boxes, one color for each character. Pink for Carol Hines, green for the professor, and orange or yellow for Dr. Cornelius.
And blue for the background lab techs, who are just repeating the same few words over and over again. Steady. Feed. Steady. Feed. And occasionally other indicators. We start out with scenes of Logan in what modern readers will come to have identified as the adamantium tank, undergoing the adamantium bonding process. Right now, he's in a super saturated, bright, almost technicolor fluid, covered with tubes, with just these simple captions set across the background. There aren't word balloons. We've just got these colored captions to disambiguate specific speakers.
And the way it goes back and forth, from technicians to Dr. Cornelius to Carol Hines, just using short, clipped phrases, conductive feed, steady, I'll compensate, etc., it manages to get this computerized feel, this clinical, impassive voice from the scientists who are doing this horrible, vicious thing to Logan inside this back-to-tank from hell.
But also a sense of surreal detachment, that this is the kind of bits and disambiguation that you'd get if you were just catching snatches of these voices through whatever Logan's hearing them through. The other thing I want to talk about on these pages, and really throughout this story, is the coloring. This is, I believe that Barry Windsor Smith is coloring his own work here. There's not a colorist credited, or a separate colorist credited. And he doesn't use the palette that you would default expect him to use here. I should say also at this point, we have a visual companion to this episode that's up on explainthexmen.com, and you may want to follow along there as we're discussing this, because this story in particular is one that's going to be augmented pretty significantly by seeing some of the panels that we're talking about.
Totally agreed, yeah. Yeah, this kind of reminds me, so I used to draw with highlighters a lot back when I was a kid. I've always loved bright colors, and it's those same kind of neon garish colors, and like, you would think that would be happy and cheery and Lisa Frank, but it's almost painful to look at. It's almost like an assault on your eyes, and it works so freaking well for the story.
Yeah, the phrase I keep on coming back to describe this particular palette is candy-colored. I feel like it's pretty much a roll of Smarties in comics form.
Jay, don't eat that candy. I'm pretty sure it'll kill you, or at least brainwash you, or at least mess with your skeleton.
Well, it's adamantium candy. You'd break your teeth before any of those things even happened.
Unless you had adamantium teeth.
My God, the plot thickens. But anyway, among all of these teals and bright pinks and sort of dreamsicle oranges, there's just a sense of weirdness, of otherness, but also of ultra-vividness. And as Miles said, I think the surreal palette does a great job of emphasizing the detachment of the people through whose eyes we're seeing this. Because we're not seeing this from Logan's perspective. We're seeing it from the perspective of the people who are doing these things to him, who are basically torturing him with this, you know, detached scientific investment.
And when the two scenes do merge, when we see the technicians outside of the tank and Logan inside it in the same panel, outside is that same cool blue, that we saw during Logan's fight with the men who brought him in. And now we do have speech bubbles. It's like there are two different worlds. And the choice of using speech bubbles versus captions, the choice of using, like, a single dark, relaxing color with multiple tones versus these garish, conflicting colors, it just gets the duality across so perfectly.
Yeah, Barry Windsor Smith is using every element of his medium to tell this story, and he's doing a great job of really stretching the sense of what comics can do.
Now, artistry aside, we find out a little bit of what's going on, because Dr. Hines mentions that Logan's body is compensating for the procedure that's being done. It's resisting, and his accelerated heart rate is drawing in too much adamantium from the adamantium reservoir.
Now, this is the first mention of adamantium in this comic, and again, while this is a familiar scene to readers who've been around more recently, because this is the thing that we flash back to when we talk about how Logan got his adamantium, this was, I believe, pretty much new at that point.
As far as how it actually got in there, yeah, I mean, we knew someone had put it there, and apparently this is that story. So one thing that's also interesting here is that as they watch Logan in the tank, the scientists notice that his wounds from the capture are gone. And what's more, they shaved him like you normally would for surgery, like his head, his body, his everything, and his body hair and hair are already back. And what's more, his hair is already in that ridiculous pointy cornered nonsense, and his sideburns are magnificent once again.
I really love that that's how he recovers, that he doesn't get a full beard. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't recover back to the state when his mutation manifested. This is where he goes, the late fucking 70s, every time.
Well, what that makes me realize is that if he's healing to his default state, that means that hairstyle is genetically ingrained. That is in Logan's very DNA. Each double helix within the nuclei of his cells has that hair.
Alternately, like literally everyone else with a mutant power they've tried to explain, he's at least slightly psionic and it reverts him to his clearest self-image or something.
It kind of reminds me of the concept of residual self-image from Orpheus, like when you die and become a ghost in this role-playing game, however you thought of yourself is how you will then permanently manifest forever, possibly with the marks of how you died, but still.
Wow, that's sort of an alarming thought.
It kind of is. I wonder what my residual self-image would be. Basically just a giant beard, and that's it.
Now, here's what interests me about this sequence. They don't know he's got a healing factor. It's going to be retconned later over and over and over that he was chosen for this experiment specifically because of his healing factor, but here they've got no idea what the hell is going on. They don't even know he's got claws.
Exactly, because at this point in continuity, Logan's claws were not part of his skeleton. The justification we get for them in this scene is that for some reason the adamantium was pooling too much around his hands and wrists and just sort of turned into claws, which I guess makes as much sense as anything else, but I like it better with the bun claws underneath.
And it just, what, resolved into claw shapes?
I mean, I guess so. I'm not going to say it makes a lot of sense, but it makes comic book sense. And the fact that the claws are so terrifying makes it work narratively, so I'll allow it.
So I'm going to make this call now. This is not adamantium with which Logan is being imbued. This is pure, distilled, molten retcon.
I totally buy that. Well, as all of this goes on, the professor goes off to have a phone call. Now, we just hear his side over Logan in the fluid once everyone has left. The professor is mad that the person on the other end apparently knew that Logan was a mutant and didn't say. Who is this person on the other end? Well, in the story, we never find out, but
Chris Claremont apparently originally intended for it to have been Apocalypse.
Right, Barry Windsor Smith had a conversation with Chris Claremont, where Claremont revealed the Apocalypse plan to Smith. And so in the Weapon X story, Smith just left it nice and ambiguous. We never even hear dialogue from the person on the other end of the phone, so it could easily be retconned into having been Apocalypse. You're a good bro, Barry Windsor Smith.
That Apocalypse Wolverine link is played up in a couple other places. It shows up, for instance, in Wolverine the Jungle Adventure, which is written by Walter Simonson and drawn by Mike Mignola, who was starting his Marvel tenure during that period. And in Inferno at one point, Archangel, who by then has been through all of Apocalypse's machines, recognizes Wolverine's scent as peculiar in ways he can't quite narrow down.
Now, as came up in the cold open, it will eventually be revealed that it was Romulus, the too-many-clawed, even Wolverinier hair-than-Wolverine dude who's apparently behind freaking everything in Wolverine's backstory, who was on the other end of the phone. Oh, I don't like that.
So, I've been thinking about this, because Romulus is bullshit. We all know Romulus is bullshit. But I don't think I would really buy Apocalypse as behind Weapon X either. I don't think he's that organized.
Well, I also don't think that he's that subtle. I mean, he'll manipulate entire cultures, but manipulating one program just for a dude with putting that much work into it, that seems excessive.
It's very much in keeping with Sinister's MO, the obsessive tracking of one family tree, the using mutant test subjects and all of that. Or, for instance, Dark Beast, although I don't think Dark Beast would even attempt to give it any kind of civic framing.
But Sinister, I totally buy. I think you're right. And I remember at the end of, what was it, X-Men Apocalypse?
Yeah, X-Men Apocalypse ties Wolverine to the Essex Corporation.
And I think that kind of works. But alas, it'll end up being dumb old Romulus. I prefer to think of it as Apocalypse because it's far more entertaining.
Okay, I'm thinking of who else you could conceivably have had it be. The High Evolutionary.
Oh yeah, the High Evolutionary did definitely do that individual manipulation. Maybe it's Kang the Conqueror because the Professor, Dr. Cornelius, Carol Hines, and Logan were all Kang himself during different periods of his own timeline.
When in doubt, it is Kang the Conqueror and or Mystique.
Ooh, good point. Totally Mystique.
Yeah, unquestionably. Literally everyone in the Marvel Universe is probably Mystique or Kang.
Well, regardless, whoever it is apparently knew that Logan was a mutant and didn't tell the Professor. And this starts a thread of paranoia within the Professor that's going to continue throughout the series, adding just another layer of thriller, espionage-y, fear-based stuff to the whole proceedings.
The Professor is not only on the receiving end of paranoia, he is doing his best to actively engender it. And the first thing he does once the adamantium bonding process is complete is set up a hapless new lab tech to get hella super murdered.
Right, because the semi-conscious Logan suddenly, grossly, gradually, and bloodily spurts claws from the back of his hands. The scientists knew that there was an excess of adamantium in Logan's hands, but the fact that they're claws? That's new. And the tech that goes in to check it out? Well, he gets a real, real close look at them.
He doesn't go in to check it out. He says that it looks like Wolverine's in pain, it looks like something's going on, it looks like he's unstable, should he check it out, should he check it out? And the Professor, who very clearly knows what the outcome is going to be, tells him, yes, why don't you go in there, lock the security door behind you, and get real close to the dangerous test subject, which the poor hapless tech does and promptly gets, as I said, hella murdered.
The significantly more compassionate Dr. Cornelius, I mean, not that he's a great guy, but at least he's more compassionate than the Professor.
Yeah, he's specifically lost his license repeatedly due to unethical human experimentation at this point, right?
That's the implication, yeah, although the fact that he's labeled as a mercy kill doctor makes me wonder if he was doing assisted suicide or something like that.
I mean, possibly, but he's also doing highly unethical human experimentation. Like, both. Both are good.
Well, regardless, he goes to see what happened to the tech who has suddenly disappeared, and he finds Logan standing bloody clawed over this kid's corpse.
Just to clarify real quick, because I made these jokes about hunting humans for sport, both are not good. Don't do experiments on people without, like, following ethical practices.
Right, there are no good guys in this story. Don't emulate anyone.
Unless you're Marsha P. Johnson, and then you can do whatever the fuck you want, and I stand by that.
Pretty much. But this kind of worries me, because the tech, he's identified as, quote, Kale or Cole or something. And yet he gets murdered. This isn't what we've come to expect from Chris Claremont's comics. Usually you have to have a full name and a brief backstory to die tragically. If Kale can die, are any of us safe?
Oh, Miles, this isn't a Chris Claremont comic. We're in Barry Windsor Smith country now.
Well, I guess we better get into that convertible, do a whole lot of drugs, and be in a Terry Gilliam movie.
Except for the Terry Gilliam part, that's basically how this series starts.
That is perhaps a very good point.
Although, man, actually Terry Gilliam's Weapon X would be fucking amazing because this comic has serious, serious throes of both Brazil and Zero Theorem.
Oh, I was thinking 12 Monkeys, but yeah, you're totally right. Gilliam could absolutely do a Weapon X movie, and that would be amazing.
It's got some of the 12 Monkeys feel, but the impassable, labyrinthine, horrific, surreal layers of impregnable bureaucracy remind me a lot of the specific mode of surrealism in this comic.
I can totally see that. Well, one person who's pleased with the way this is going, despite the horrific murder that just occurred, is the Professor, who says, simply,
magnificent.
And Dr. Cornelius is furious with the Professor. He knew that he was getting into some shady shit, but he had no idea that they would just be creating a monster like this, a beast.
No, not a monster, exactly.
devil with that. It's a mindless murdering animal.
Yes. But we can make him behave.
And to bring Dr. Cornelius further down this horrifying rabbit hole, the professor tells Cornelius about something he hadn't heard about before.
This rabbit hole is terrible. This rabbit hole is really bloody and it's full of adamantium and lots of murders.
It's freaking Watership Down in here, yeah. But anyway,
Sorry.
I'm so glad you approve.
Well played, sir. You're not wrong.
Well, anyway, the professor tells Cornelius about mutants, about Homo Superior. Dr. Cornelius hadn't heard of mutants before, and at this point in Marvel continuity, that makes sense. And this is actually a brilliant move on the professor's part, because by telling Cornelius that Logan is a different species and not human, that makes this seem a little more okay. That allows Cornelius to justify what he's doing to himself.
Yeah, Cornelius only needs a mild nudge, I will point out. And this is something that's addressed at somewhat more length when Cornelius himself is killed along with Logan in the Death of Wolverine miniseries that came out in 2014, which would actually make a really good paired reading with this particular series.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's another justification the professor gives Cornelius, which is, this was always Logan's destiny. I mean, they all knew what he did once he was fired from the government agency he was part of. He started drinking and fighting and doing drugs and just completely losing himself as some kind of a beast. All the professor and Dr. Cornelius and Carol Hines are doing is unleashing the destiny that was already within Logan. They're helping him be more himself than he even could have been on his own.
I love reading more into this than was clearly intended and thinking of all of the things that it could be a clear metaphor for.
Oh,
and
yeah?
I'm thinking of more movie references, too, specifically Jacob's Ladder.
Oh, man, now there's a thematic mashup that could be fascinating.
Right? Well, again, this has the same kind of weirdness and surrealism and specifically layered realities as that. God, that is my favorite Christmas movie.
Right?
I mean,
best Santa Claus.
Basically, Jacob's Ladder is what Christmas means to me, so...
That's slightly terrifying, Jay.
I mean, look, you know, you were there.
Fair.
No, but the ways that they are talking about him remind me a lot of the deep shittiness of a lot of the public dialogue around mentally ill veterans.
Mm-hmm. I can totally see that.
And especially before PTSD was a recognized serious thing. And I think still in a lot of circles around those conversations, the idea, you know, that this person who is profoundly and deeply damaged and has been profoundly and deeply damaged in context of basically service to his country. Although with Logan, we of course, as readers know that it goes back further, but still is now functionally valueless and discarded and there to be picked up and abused in further ways, which is really super uncool.
And the dehumanization of Logan continues, of the so far completely oblivious and mostly unconscious since he got to the facility, Logan. We see him in this sort of electronic coffin with metal rods piercing his body everywhere, presumably something to do with the adamantium infusion, and yards of cables just wrapped around him and under him while the trio watches like they're watching some kind of object.
Yards and yards of electrical cable, we should say, not of Nathan Christopher Ascanison Summers.
Right, this is complicated enough already. We don't need to bring Nathan into this one.
We really don't. And I don't think those things are related to the adamantium bonding process. I think they're an early stage of the mind control process because Cornelius is setting the professor up with an audio interface that he can use to control Logan.
Right. The professor tests it out and speaks into it, sounding every bit the mad scientist.
You have one master, and it is me. You will do anything I say.
And they begin to test Logan, watching what's going on in his head on a sort of television screen above him as they do so, and what we see is horrifying. There are all these spurs and spikes just protruding out of this disembodied, twisted skeleton, 6-inch spines coming out of his ribs and skull and even eyeballs.
And this is something that is very clearly going to come back up as having been the visual reference for when the adamantium gets ripped out of his skeleton in Fatal Attractions, by the way.
And I do love that. Like, in Fatal Attractions, spoiler going forward, Magneto rips the adamantium out of Logan's skeleton, revealing for the first time that Logan has bone claws, that they weren't made of pure metal. But those spikes being pulled out, like, it's just such a clear analog to the pain, the agony that was so beautifully established in Weapon X. It's a good thematic well to return to by the Fatal Attractions team.
It's so convenient that they have a computer that can literally just broadcast this dude's thoughts. At this point, he's just screaming, pain, so it's sort of a very Devil in the Dark Horta moment.
It kind of is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look, he was just getting in those bar fights to protect his eggs, okay?
No kill.
No kill I. Aw, man. I have so much more sympathy for Logan now that I've compared him to a Horta.
Right? Well, the pain he's experiencing is enough to wake him up, to bring him back into the real world, and he screams and attacks Carol and the professor. He's tranquilized by the guards after the professor's verbal commands do nothing. This is something we'll keep coming back to, that the fury, the animalistic rage, and just the sheer humanity maybe within Logan is stronger than technology.
Now, what do you do when your order interface goes down with the patient you're experimenting on? This is a multiple choice test. Do you A, take a while to troubleshoot and reboot it? B, rethink the ethics of your experiment and maybe, like, go off to a monastery or something to spend the rest of your life in deep penance for being such a ragingly horrible person? Or C, send him out into the snow naked to fight some wolves?
Let's go with option C.
And with that, you could work for Weapon X.
So, yeah, Logan is out in the snow, naked, with a bunch of cameras on him, and wolves released quickly to fight him to see what he'll do, and he does, initially, a whole lot of nothing. They start tearing him apart, and at some point during the attack, during the violence, his adrenaline kicks in just enough for him to snap, for him to fight back, and for those claws in the back of his hand to emerge, not in the way we're used to, but slowly, agonizingly, bit by bit, ripping and tearing flesh.
Right, instead of a clean snicked, we get some of the most gruesome sound effects, and it sounds weird to say that because they're kind of not in and of themselves, but if you think of them as the sounds that claws are making while extending through flesh and skin, we've got sort of this path and a lot of gurgly noises that I can't quite replicate.
Right, and it makes sense that they don't come out straight. These aren't the clean blades or rounded spikes we've seen artists portray later. These are these sort of jagged, irregular spines with little sub-spines and stuff coming off to the side. Like, it's just so visceral imagining those ripping through your flesh, coming out inch by inch by inch.
The professor is all about this. Despite his original protestations, I know we've done him a great favor. His most bestial needs are about to exceed his most primitive dreams. In our service, of course. You can turn him off now, Doctor.
And with this phase of the testing apparently successful, the professor orders Dr. Cornelius to go into the next, which is a remote control setup, something that will allow the professor to direct Logan from up to 10 miles away. And this is an image you have probably seen, especially if you were collecting action figures in the early 90s, because they made one.
That's so fucking weird, of like angry naked Logan covered with electronics.
Yeah, I mean, the action figure, he was wearing tiny short shorts as well, but
this is also basically the version of Wolverine that you saw in X-Men Apocalypse, if you're more familiar with the movie continuity.
Right, he's got little electronic boxes that are sort of hanging from him by these wires that he's tangled all around that are going into him, into this big helmet with a giant visor that he's wearing. It looks like a VR helmet almost.
I mean, it looks not almost, it looks like a VR helmet, and it may in fact be, and we'll get into more of that later, but Wolverine is out here to fight a bear.
Yeah, we've gone from wolves to bears, and this is no demon bear, but it's pretty intimidating. I mean, bears are good at being intimidating.
Yeah, I was gonna say, dude, like, the demon bear is a challenge to New Mutants, but bears are really dangerous. We've talked about this on the podcast before. Don't fight bears. They will fuck you up and then kill you and then fuck you up further and then maybe eat you.
Well, it's no problem for Logan because within a matter of seconds, if even that, the bear's head and the bear's body are in two different places. The professor remains ecstatic. This is going beautifully. Weapon X is turning into a fine weapon indeed.
And Cornelius and the techs are happy with Logan's progress, but they want to take things a little bit slower. The professor, on the other hand, has no such patience. He thinks it's time for the final test. Logan has fought bears, and now he must face the most dangerous game.
You mean badminton with dynamite while riding rhinoceri?
That is exactly what I mean.
Well, okay, no, it's actually man. And I gotta say, I'm imagining, like, a much younger trio of the murder grandpas, a nation away, their ears perk up and they don't know why, but they're very excited suddenly.
Cornelius, on the other hand, is starting to have second thoughts, and once the professor's out of the room, he expresses some of those to Caroline's.
I'm not too large on soul-searching and like that, but I've got some responsibility to, you know, stuff. I ain't got murder inside me, Hines. Not like the professor.
Ah, responsibility to stuff.
But I kind of like that, because Cornelius, he's a scientist, yes, and he's apparently a brilliant scientist based on the work he's done. Like, he's mostly responsible for the technology behind Weapon X, but at the same time, the fact that he talks like just a dude kind of makes it work. It makes him, if not more sympathetic, at least much more human than the professor.
Giving Cornelius the qualms he has distracts, I think, from one of the more salient aspects of what's going on, which is that he still proceeds perfectly happily with the experiments.
It's true, yeah. I mean, the fact is he still does it. It kind of reminds me of Stanley Milgram's obedience studies. Stanley Milgram was a psychologist who, after World War II, wanted to basically show through testing that the Nazis were just evil, that normal people wouldn't just follow orders. And so he presented his subjects with a test where they were supposed to electrocute people on the other end of a radio who got test questions wrong. And the tester, the sort of psychologist running the show, would encourage them to keep escalating the electricity more and more and more, even after the person on the other end protested.
Well, and even after it seemed to have severely physically harmed them, we should say at this point that the people on the other end who were ostensibly getting shocked were not. They were, in fact, actors.
Exactly. So it was just a test to figure out how far would people go if they were following orders. And sadly, very, very far.
This is something to remember currently, by the way.
Yes, it certainly is.
It is salient to current situations and stuff. But it's also salient to what's going on with Cornelius and also to some extent, I think, with Hines.
Absolutely. Well, they all head off and Logan, dormant, is watched by one of the technicians and suddenly he activates and murders the fuck out of said technician and shreds the door, killing guard after guard after guard. It's gone from just a quiet Logan who barely looked like he was even alive to carnage, to slaughter.
To the common noun carnage, not the symbiote infected supervillain carnage.
Well, regardless, it's really hard to get across in audio format just how troubling these visuals are, how overwhelming they are.
And that's why we once again recommend that you check out the visual companion to this post at explainthexmen.com.
Right. Well, Logan just kills person after person after person, and from afar, the professor tries to use his voice commands to shut Logan down. It doesn't work. Soldiers try to shoot Logan with tranquilizer darts. They don't work, and Logan just keeps tearing everybody apart.
So I want to digress briefly and talk about this command system. And specifically, I mean, Miles, you are a psychology major.
You have
a bachelor's degree, which I assume qualifies you to judge this. Where would you put the voice commands in terms of feasibility relative to the text adventure commands in X-Men Origins Wolverine?
Okay, so that's tough because, you know, the brain does have voice centers. Our brains are very based around language, and so voice commands could kind of work, probably more than text commands would. I mean, I feel like it's a higher brain function to read than to listen. At the same time, if the text adventure commands were really just translated to electrical signals, if that was just what the user saw and the electrical signals were what the target experienced, then that would make a lot more sense to me.
What about mind control as a text adventure? Like, you type in, go north, and then Deadpool just stands up and goes, there are mountains to the north. You're like, go east. I can't go east. Go west? The fourth wall is to the west. Scale the fourth wall? Question mark?
I mean, that would certainly slow mad scientists down enough to probably prevent some horrible things from happening.
Now I'm actually irate that there are no Deadpool text adventure games because I feel like he's a character singularly suited to that medium.
I think he kind of is. But back to, you know, the legitimately horrifying violence going on.
While this is going down, the professor gets back in touch with his mysterious contact outside.
And once again, we just hear the professor's side of this conversation as he gets increasingly panicked and angry.
There is just one thing. Let me ask. Should I leave now? Or should I refuge here? Whilst, as you put it, Weapon X clears the dead wood.
And Cornelius and Carol are trying to get in touch with the professor this entire time. He's ignoring them completely. They realize that Logan is going straight for the professor, cutting his way through guards, through metal walls, through everything in his path.
Cornelius finally authorizes the guards to use deadly force, which accomplishes precisely jack shit.
Because Logan has made it to the professor, and all we and Cornelius hear are the sounds of ripping and screaming over the radio.
Logan has torn his way through all of the guards, gets straight to the professor, and cuts off one of his hands.
And as this happens, you know, we had that division before between the cool, simple colors of the lab and the color-coded captions, and then the speech bubbles and yelling and violent garish colors of Logan's own pain. Yeah, now it's all speech bubbles, it's all garish colors, it's all pain. Logan has brought his world to the people who have done this to him.
Logan tears his way back through the guards. And in another comic, this is a scene that would look heroic. It reminds me a little bit of the sewers below the Hellfire Club, but here it's just carnage.
Yeah, it's just ugly. It's kind of like how The Last of Us does violence, as opposed to a game where fighting is fun. Like, in The Last of Us, violence is just, it just makes you feel bad for participating in it, for even seeing it, and that's how it is here.
I think this was the point in reading where I started texting you about how I wanted to see Barry Windsor Smith adapt The Thing as a comic.
Oh, that would work so well. I completely agree. He would also do, like, the grotesque monstrousness of the various creatures real well.
It would be grotesque and beautiful, but the thing that he accomplishes just beautifully here is the overwhelm, the cacophony, and just, I mean, it's great. It's some of the best action horror that I've seen executed in any medium.
Well, the professor, minus his hand, Dr. Cornelius and Hines, do manage to meet up as the guards are slaughtered, basically to a man. They are all killed, and they figure, okay, where could we possibly be safe? Well, there's the nuclear reactor, the adamantium reactor hold. Maybe there?
Pro tip, as someone who has read any fiction ever, never hide in the fucking nuclear reactor. Don't do bad choices. Bad moves, buddy.
And indeed, while we do get a little bit of those color-coded captions of the simpler colors, as they feel that they're safe, that goes away because Logan's in the goddamn walls like some kind of furry xenomorph.
The power goes dark as Logan presumably cuts his way through relevant wires. The professor is on the phone trying to get in touch with his boss. He's bleeding everywhere. He's muttering, and there's no answer. And Cornelius and Hines are trying to figure out what to do. They've only got one rifle between them. Without power, the reactor is going to blow. It's in big trouble. That's really bad. You should have a manual cutoff in your reactor, Weapon X.
I kind of feel like Weapon X has made a lot of poor decisions, and they all come to roost when suddenly, in the darkness, there's Logan. Monstrous, giant-haired, covered in blood, and terrifying.
Now, the plan that Hines, Cornelius, and the professor have come up with, and I put plan in heavy scare quotes here, is for Cornelius to attempt to shoot some of the wires and electronics on Weapon X, which will presumably render him inert. They've been able to find one rifle among the lot of them. And unfortunately, as Cornelius lines up his shot, the professor just kind of knocks the hell into him. The rifle fires into Logan, and Logan promptly jumps Cornelius and tears him to bits.
And this is fucked because Logan paused. He didn't immediately try to kill everyone. Cornelius also paused, waiting to see what would happen. And if the professor hadn't gotten terrified and impatient and hit Cornelius, causing him to fire, maybe things wouldn't have gone so bad. But Dr. Cornelius, maybe not sympathetic, but definitely more sympathetic than the professor, he's toast. He is shredded.
Literally everyone is more sympathetic than the professor, which leaves us, and Logan as well. We get from him here one of the first glimpses we've seen of his humanity as he lingers over Cornelius's body while the professor and Hines flee.
I know this man in a memory, a dream of dying.
Hines is doing her best to find a way to prevent a meltdown because she is literally the only sensible person on this team. And I actually thought for a while that maybe she was secretly the mastermind behind it, but it turns out she's not.
No, she's just a lady that signed up at very much the wrong job and didn't get out during the maybe 50 different times when she probably should have.
Yeah, like that's really the point where you give up the pension and walk. Actually, about a year before this in comics time is where you give up the pension and walk. And the professor immediately points out that, well, Cornelius gave his life for the project. Wouldn't Hines do the same?
And she answers him.
No, sir, I wouldn't want to die.
To which the professor responds,
it is required, madam.
And he pushes her over the goddamn railing 20 feet below onto the ground of the reactor.
Come on, woman. Scream, will you? Think of the horror of it all. Use your imagination.
And scream she does as the professor prepares to purge the reactor, and Hines begs Logan, who, of course, is right there very quickly, to just kill her quickly, to spare her the physical pain. And it's just, it's pitiful, not in like a way where you want to mock Carol Hines, not in a way where you look down upon her, but just where you feel bad for her, where you pity her.
Unless you're the professor, in which case you yell at her for not being sufficiently dignified as she faces death because the professor is a raging asshole. Logan, on the other hand, has a bit more respect for Hines.
I understand. I understand you. You don't matter to me. I want.
But then the explosions begin and Logan falls on fire, his skin blistering and tearing from the bone.
The professor tries to call his boss again. Everything is going to shit right now.
This is the professor. Experiment X is destroyed, and I am his destroyer. Do you hear me? I beat you.
But apparently not, because the purge that the professor just initiated to blow Logan up, it's remotely canceled. The reactor is okay. And so, apparently, is Logan.
Okay might be a stretch there. I mean, he doesn't really have any skin.
Well, you know, what he does have, though, is fury and claws and language back. He's starting to come more and more into his own as a person again.
As he bursts through the glass to attack the professor, he demands,
"Am I dead?"
"You are an animal!"
"I am Logan! Logan! I am a man!"
The professor tries to call for help, but there's no one left. And we watch Logan's face in close-up as the sound effects in the blood tell us that first one, then a second, and a third claw have gone through the professor's head, killing him.
And Logan drops the professor's corpse into the reactor, Darth Vader style, and suddenly wakes up as rectangular, brilliantly colored, garish lights come on a black background. Logan's conscious, but he keeps hearing dialogue from the entire story so far, inserted in random orders at a random pace in random situations.
So Logan assumes that what he's hearing are disjointed bits of ambient recordings being played back. And he's not sure what's going on, but he does find the professor's severed hand and Dr. Cornelius's body.
And he doesn't remember what he did to them, but his claws maybe do because they slowly, agonizingly come out of their new housings that the techs created after filing them down.
And he starts to remember what happened as he runs, adamantium spines bursting out of the ground around him like he's in some kind of nightmare.
"Something's behind me, moving with me, like a living shadow. It's at my heels. And if I slow down, it'll get me. I'll suffocate in it, in its darkness. And I won't be able to scream, or yell, or fight it off. Because it'll be inside me."
The background goes abstract, black and neon as Logan runs. More spikes come up around him and then out of his body, more and longer, and his fingers and hair elongate. And suddenly we've got current commentary again from the professor and Dr. Cornelius.
They're commenting with interest on all of this. They're apparently alive, and what Logan's seeing, having gone so far outside of reality, is clearly a hallucination. What the hell? What was real? What wasn't?
Well, what is real is the snow leopard he then encounters.
Because this is the next test. Having put Logan through this psychological hallucinatory ringer, now they're going to see how he fares against a threat without any remote control equipment. Just a naked furry man with metal claws and severe psychological issues.
I mean, what else do you really need?
Well, apparently not much, because this snow leopard is fucking dead almost immediately. That killer is still inside Logan as his mind has been more and more destroyed.
Aw, man, all it really wanted to do was hang out and chew on its own tail.
I know, big cats are just like, you know, normal cats. They're cute, except they'll also maul you.
Well, snow leopards specifically have super long tails, which they will occasionally control by holding them in their mouths.
Well, that's just adorable. Now I feel even worse for it.
It is. It's super, super, super delightful. They are the second most adorable leopards.
Well, what we're back to again is those color-coded captions, those clean colors, because the trio, the techs, are once again safe. They're once again watching dispassionately, and even Dr. Cornelius, who had seemed so human, even Carol Hines, who had seemed so helpless, yeah, right now, they just see Logan as a test, once again.
And the professor concludes that they've gotten to the root of what it's going to take to program Logan to his fear of his own bestial instincts. That is the thing they have to basically force him to face off against.
And so, having shut Logan down remotely, they send a couple of handlers to go retrieve him and bring him back into the facility.
But Logan kills them.
Yeah, Logan's got enough humanity, individuality, fury, whatever, to wake up and slaughter them, and immediately the facility is engulfed in panic. People are calling back and forth, radioing back and forth from different parts of the lab to others, wondering what the hell's going on.
And it almost perfectly evokes Logan's apparent first escape. So precisely, in fact, that it leaves us wondering if it's real, especially since the final image of the main story is an enraged and bloody Logan and the three horrified faces of the Professor Cornelius and Carol Hines, with the caption, "The End."
And we get that nice ambiguous ending, but it's not the last part of the comic. Because the next thing we see in a section marked Interlude and Escape is Logan walking through a blizzard under the Aurora Borealis.
And again, this is one of those places where Barry Windsor Smith's colors just define the story so, so exquisitely. There are so many boring ways to draw someone walking through the snow, and this is none of them.
And it's also a perfect contrast, because we get garish colors in the Aurora, but they're curved and natural. They're not in harsh machinery. And we get a blank, almost non-existent white in the snow, but now it just feels like purity. It just feels like safety and simplicity.
Yeah, it's an organic and natural contrast to the technological cacophony that we've seen throughout the rest of the comic. It's almost like emerging into a different world.
But we're not done with what was left from the facility, because we get still some colored captions of Dr. Cornelius and Carol Hines talking, presumably well before any of the slaughter at the end happened.
"I don't know what to tell you, Hines. I'm going on what the professor said. Maybe anything other than that is out of my league."
"I think the professor is a liar, sir."
"Yeah, maybe."
"I wish I had never become involved with Experiment X, sir."
"Yeah, me too, I guess. Come on, cheer up, Hinesy. Be over soon."
And this is juxtaposed over Logan making his way further and further up the mountain he's climbing. And with that, the Weapon X story concludes. So goddamn, that was great.
I know. I'd actually never read Weapon X before. This was my first time. I'd certainly heard about what it was about, but I never thought it would just be this engaging to see Wolverine mostly out of it for the entire story and just three scientists being assholes at him. But God, I was so drawn in, like, immediately.
Yeah, this feels like a really, really good one-off X-Files episode.
Ooh, yeah, good call.
It's got, or, you know, I made the connection to The Thing earlier. It's got that sense of pacing and timing and of detachment, but again, it works so beautifully, and it's so fundamentally and exquisitely a comic. Although I think it would work really, really exquisitely animated, too. Has anyone ever really done animation that deliberately tries to replicate Barry Windsor Smith's line style?
I don't think so. I mean, we've certainly seen scenes from Weapon X, most notably Logan in that big pool of liquid with all the metal stuff stuck in him, in the movies, in the cartoons, you know, varying degrees of gruesome in the much more PG-rated cartoons, but
in literally everything.
Yeah, but never really in any style meant to evoke Barry Windsor Smith. It was always house style.
And I mean, I assume you'd have to do pretty time-intensive hand-drawn animation for this, but man, if someone ever did a series of Animatrix-style X-Men shorts or something, which I'd love to see, this would be a terrific, terrific story to adapt.
I'm still stuck on Terry Gilliam doing a Weapon X movie.
Or, again, a Weapon X short. I don't know that you could or should sustain a movie on this. It works as extended as it does because of the medium it's in, but I think if you tried to pace it out to fill 90 minutes of screen time, you'd lose a lot.
And along those lines, I'm really glad this story, even though we read it in one go ourselves as we were preparing, was done serially. I'm glad it's done in little 8-page chapters, because breaking it up like that really gets across the methodical nature of the experiment. And when things go haywire, it gets that across as well, as that pace is broken.
That said, we read it as chapters in basically a story that was all connected. And I'm really curious, I'd love to hear from people who read it in Marvel Comics Presents as it was coming out monthly, and how well they were able to follow it.
So that's Weapon X, but boy howdy have there ever been follow-ups. This was basically the beginning of Logan's backstory getting more and more complicated.
And it's also the beginning of Wolverine having canonical origins. In Wolverine number 50 by Larry Hama, it's going to be revealed that lots of Logan's memories were implanted by the Weapon X project, but that a lot of what went on in this particular story was real.
I gotta say, though, that's a really nice out when you have a character with this much backstory being able to just say, yeah, that thing, I didn't like it. That didn't happen. That was manipulation.
Yeah, and it also sets Logan up for one of my favorite formats of storytelling in shared superhero universes, which is basically just what-if stories, that you could do an entire Logan version of, like, the Secret Wars miniseries. Obviously, I'm talking about the most recent Secret Wars that had all of the weird little embedded Elseworlds miniseries within it.
Right. Well, and speaking of things that might as well have been alternate universes based on how weird they were, we found out in Grant Morrison's run of X-Men that Weapon X is actually Weapon 10. It's a Roman numeral. There were 9 before it, and a bunch after, and Captain America was Weapon 1.
We did a cold open about them once.
Oh god, I'm surprised we only have done one. There were more Weapon X's other than Logan, though, more characters who were called Weapon X, and the best sort of no-prize solution I've seen for that is that the Weapon 10 / Weapon X project splintered off, forks off, if you will, the Weapon Number project, and just started doing its own thing, which, yeah, I mean, that kind of makes sense. The way government agencies get so complicated, I'll totally buy that.
Now, a lot of the scrubs at the lab are also going to figure back into continuity later on. The professor, as we mentioned in the cold open, will later be revealed to be a fellow named Truett Hudson. He is Wolverine's distant cousin and the half-brother of James Hudson, formerly Guardian, because of fucking course he is.
Everything connects. And a couple characters who didn't even get names, who weren't even, like, specifically defined in this series, would later be retconned in to have been kind of a big deal. There was a random guard who Logan clawed named Malcolm Colcord. He later becomes quite a big deal, in fact, restarting Weapon X and creating a mutant concentration camp called Neverland.
So following in the footsteps of Macon, Cole, and Reese, those random-ass Hellfire Club guards who Wolverine clawed up during the Dark Phoenix saga, who went on to become the Reavers.
Exactly. And perhaps even more important, we have a dude named Dale Rice, who is a scientist that Logan apparently killed while he was escaping, you know, off-panel completely, because we don't actually see Logan's escape. His son will create X-23 after becoming obsessed with a Weapon X project and obsessed with getting revenge against Logan or anybody who resembles him, like, say, Laura Kinney.
Cornelius and the Professor both survive the end of the Weapon X miniseries, and they both come back. Dr. Cornelius, in fact, is going to be there at the other end of Logan's story. He is the indirect cause of Logan's death in the 2014 Death of Wolverine miniseries, but Logan manages to take him out as well, so, you know, good times all around.
So, that's what we have for you as far as Weapon X, but as far as what you have for us, you've got questions.
Etheric Oddball asks on Tumblr, has Cyclops ever had any drastic changes or developments to his powers that have stuck with him like the other original five? From what I've noticed, we've had Jean as Phoenix, Angel becoming Archangel, Snow Bobby learning to become Ice Bobby, and Hank, you know, turning into Furry Hank, but I can't think of Cyclops ever having a, quote, my powers have drastically grown / changed story.
Well, not really. I mean, they've been turned off or made controllable a handful of times so that we could actually see Scott's eyes, but we've never had a drastic alteration the way we have with the other four original X-Men. I mean, they were messed up in poorly defined ways after Scott became Dark Phoenix-ish during Avengers vs. X-Men, but that was just usually shown as his optic blast still being present and still being basically the same idea, but being jagged or split.
We've seen them take on dramatically different forms a few times, such as in the case where they're fueled by lightning he absorbs in an annual. But for the most part, it's still the same power set, and they never really get significantly upgraded. So yeah, Cyclopses stay pretty consistent. I guess they occasionally get different explanations, but they still work in pretty much the same fundamental way.
I'm looking at you, dimension of pure force.
You don't want to look at that, man. It hits pretty hard.
I have my eclipse glasses, it'll be fine.
That's not how they work, buddy.
Well, anyway, Herr Bishop Blog asks on Tumblr, so my question is for Jay. Now that you're in New York, how many X-Men locales have you tried to find, and have you entered the sewers looking for the Morlocks yet?
I haven't gone looking for any X-Men locations, and the main reason for that is that after extensive Googling, I know that the Coffee a Go-Go no longer exists.
Aww.
That is the location I would totally have tracked down, but alas, I can no longer do so. I did accidentally stumble across the Rainbow Room while I was on my way to somewhere else, but I haven't actually been inside. That said, my wife has been to the actual honest-to-God Hellfire Club before, so that's a thing.
Oh, man.
Although apparently it has since turned into kind of a douchey bar, which is unfortunate.
That is unfortunate.
And I guess, I went to North Salem once, or at least the train station, again on the way to somewhere else. I don't know if that really counts, but yeah, that's what I got. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're getting there.
And Central Park, I guess. The X-Men just kind of live in Central Park now, and I've hung out there a bunch. I have taken naps there on rocks before because I'm secretly a lizard. But alas, that's all I've got. If you can think of places that I ought to track down that are still cool and that are comics accurate, I will happily go explore them. But in the absence of a Coffee a Go-Go, it just feels kind of empty.
Well, regardless, we are an entirely listener-supported podcast, and some of those tiers of support come with on-air acknowledgement from a variety of fictional characters or concepts. So even though Chris Claremont didn't write this one, let's nonetheless turn it over to the infamous Angry Claremontian narrator.
How long have you been running, Chris Carr? How many times have you broken free of your captors, only to find yourself lost still deeper in their twisted mazes at the mercy of Kelly Tweeton? Honestly, some people just never learn.
And I believe I'm handing things over to the villain who might have been in this story, the one, the only, Apocalypse.
For untold millennia, the subtlety and subterfuge of Apocalypse has shaped history as wind shapes the land itself. But even a master of shadows shall not brook an imposter claiming credit for work not his own. Joe Cawley, it was I, Apocalypse, not you, who masterminded the work of Professor Harry Thomas. You shall soon receive a visit from four of my most dedicated employees, Cawley, and shall pay for your insolence. Now, Thomas, begin the adamantium bonding process anew. And if you are unsure of our org chart, contact Human Resources. So speaks Apocalypse.
Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men is recorded in Forest Hills, New York and Portland, Oregon, and produced by Kurt Lloyd, host of the Fun and Funny Comic Book Cover Story, which you can find on YouTube.
New episodes of our show come out Sundays on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and at explainthexmen.com.
Check out explainthexmen.com for all kinds of extra content, visual companions to every episode, along with interviews, fan art, recaps, reviews, and more.
This show is totally listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air and ad-free, check out the Patreon link at the top of explainthexmen.com.
Next week in real life, come see us at Rose City Comic Con. Meanwhile, on the podcast, we'll be returning to the pages of Marvel Comics Presents
as Colossus spends some quality time in flyover country, and Cyclops faces off against Master Mold.